sniveling. Like about 15 years, like that long. It takes 15 years for women to get pregnant when they're just fucking other women. Boy, that's some effort, Melanie said. She went to the window and looked at the view of the Kennebec. In the summer, the trees were so leafy that the river was hard to see. She let a summer breeze dry the sweat on her neck and chest before she started packing.
"Please don't go. Please don't leave me," Lorna said, who was still all balled up on the bed.
"I'm packing up your things," Melanie said. "I'm not the one who's pregnant. I don't have to go nowhere."
"Don't throw me out," Lorna said miserably. "Beat me, but don't throw me out."
"You take the train to St. Cloud's. When you get there, you ask for the orphanage," Melanie told her friend.
"It was just a guy. Just one guy, and it was just once," Lorna cried.
"No, it wasn't," Melanie said. "A guy gets you pregnant fast. With women, it takes 15 years. When she had packed up Lorna's things, Melanie stood over the bed and shook her friend, who tried to hide under the bed covers.
15 years, Melanie cried.
She shook Lorna and shook her, but that was all she did to her. She even walked Lorna to the train. Lorna looked very disheveled, and it was only the early morning of what would be a wilting summer day.
"I ask for the orphanage?" Lorna asked numbly.
In addition to her suitcase, Melanie handed Lorna a big carton.
"And you give this to an old woman named Grogan, if she's still alive," Melanie said. "Don't say nothing to her, just give it to her. And if she's dead or not there anymore—"
Melanie started to say, then she stopped. "Forget that," she said. "She's either there or she's dead, and if she's dead, bring the carton back. You can give it back to me when you pick up the rest of your stuff."
"The rest of my stuff?" Lorna said.
"I was faithful to you. I was loyal as a dog," Melanie said, more loudly than she'd meant to speak, because a conductor looked at her strangely, as if she were a dog.
"You see something you want, shitface?" Melanie asked the conductor.
"The train is about to leave," he mumbled.
"Please don't throw me out," Lorna whispered to Melanie.
"I hope you have a real monster inside you," Melanie told her friend. "I hope it tears you to pieces when they drag it out your door."
Lorna fell down in the aisle of the train as if she'd been punched, and Melanie left her in a heap. The conductor helped Lorna to her feet and into her seat. Out the window of the moving train, he watched Melanie walking away. That was when the conductor noticed that he was shaking almost as violently as Lorna. Melanie thought about Lorna arriving in St. Cloud's. That turd of a station master, would he still be there? That long walk uphill with her suitcase and the large carton for Mrs. Grogan, could Lorna make it? And would the old man still be in the business? She'd not been angry for 15 years, but now here was another betrayal, and Melanie pondered how readily her anger had returned. It made all her senses keener. She felt the itch to pick apples again. She was surprised that it was not with vengeance that she thought of Homer Wells. She remembered how she'd first loved having Lorna as a pal, in part because she could complain to Lorna about what Homer had done to her. Now Melanie imagined she'd like to complain about Lorna to Homer Wells. "That little bitch," she'd tell Homer. "If there was anybody with a bulge in his pants, she couldn't keep her eyes off it." "Right," Homer would say. And together they would demolish a building, just shove it into time. When time passes, it's the people who knew you whom you want to see. They're the ones you can talk to. When enough time passes, what's it matter what they did to you? Melanie discovered that she could think like this for 1 minute. But in the next minute, when she thought of Homer Wells, she thought she'd like to kill him. When Lorna came back from St. Cloud's and went to the boarding house to retrieve her things, she found that everything had been neatly packed and boxed and gathered in one corner of the room. Melanie was at work, so Lorna took her things and left. After that, they would see each other perhaps once a week at the shipyard, or at the pizza bar in Bath, where everyone from the yard went. On these occasions, they were polite but silent. Only once did Melanie speak to her. "The old woman, Grogan. She was alive?" Melanie asked.
"I didn't bring the box back, did I?" Lorna asked.
"So you gave it to her?" Melanie asked. "And you didn't say nothing?"
I just asked if she was alive, and one of the nurses said she was, so I gave the carton to one of the nurses, as I was leaving, Lorna said.
And the doctor? Melanie asked. Old Larch, is he alive?
Barely, Lorna said.
I'll be damned, said Melanie. Did it hurt?
Not much, Lorna said cautiously.
Too bad, Melanie said. It should have hurt a lot.
In her boarding house, where she was now the sole superintendent, she took from a very old electrician's catalog a yellowed article and photograph from the local newspaper. She went to the antiques shop that was run by her old, dim-witted devotee, Mary Agnes Cork, whose adoptive parents had treated her well. They'd even put her in charge of the family store. Melanie asked Mary Agnes for a suitable frame for the newspaper article and the photograph, and Mary Agnes was delighted to come up with something perfect. It was a genuine Victorian frame taken from a ship that had been overhauled in the Bath Yards. Mary Agnes sold Melanie the frame for much less than it was worth, even though Melanie was rich. Electricians are well paid, and Melanie had been working full-time for the shipyard for 15 years. Because she was the superintendent of the boarding house, she lived almost rent-free. She didn't own a car, and she bought all her clothes at Sam's Army Navy Men's Store. It was fitting that the frame was teak, the wood of the tree that had held Wally Worthington in the air over Burma for one whole night. Because the newspaper article was about Captain Worthington, and the picture, which Melanie had recognized 15 years ago, was also of Wally. The article was all about the miraculous rescue of the downed and paralyzed pilot who had been awarded the Purple Heart. As far as Melanie was concerned, the whole story resembled the plot of a cheap and unlikely adventure movie, but she liked the picture, and the part of the article that said Wally was a local hero, a Worthington from those Worthingtons who for years had owned and managed the Ocean View Orchards in Hart's Rock. In her bedroom, in her boarding house in Bath, Melanie hung the antique frame containing the article and photograph over her bed. In the darkness, she liked knowing it was there, over her head, like history. She liked that as much as looking at the photograph in the daylight hours, and in the darkness, she would linger over the syllables of that hero's name. Worthington, she liked to say aloud. Ocean View, she said at other times. She was more familiar with saying this. Hart's Rock, she would say, spitting the short words out. In those pre-dawn hours, which are the toughest for insomniacs, Melanie would whisper, 15 years. And just before she would fall asleep, she would ask of the first flat light that crept into her bedroom, Are you still there, sunshine? What is hardest to accept about the passage of time is that the people who once mattered the most to us are wrapped up in parentheses. For 15 years, Homer Wells had taken responsibility for the writing and the posting of the Cider House rules. Every year it was the last thing he attached to the wall after the fresh coat of paint had dried. Some years he tried being jolly with the rules. Other years he tried sounding nonchalant. Perhaps it had been Olive's tone and not the rules themselves that had caused some offense, and thereby made it a matter of pride with the migrants that the rules should never be obeyed. The rules themselves did not change much. The rotary screen had to be cleaned out. A word of warning about the drinking and the falling asleep in the cold storage room was mandatory. And long after the Ferris wheel at Cape Kenneth was torn down and there were so many lights on the coast that the view from the cider house roof resembled a glimpse of some distant city, the migrants still sat on the roof and drank too much and fell off. And Homer Wells would ask or tell them not to. Rules, he guessed, never asked. Rules told. But he tried to make the cider house rules seem friendly. He phrased the rules in a confiding voice. There have been some accidents on the roof over the years, especially at night, and especially in combination with having a great deal to drink while sitting on the roof. We recommend that you do your drinking with both feet on the ground, Homer would write. But every year the piece of paper itself would become worn and tattered and used for other things, a kind of desperation grocery list, for example, always by someone who couldn't spell. Corn meal, M-E-E-L,
Regular Flower, F-L-O-W-E-R, was written across Homer's rules 1 year. At times, the solitary sheet of paper gathered little insults and mockeries of a semi-literate nature. No fucking on the roof, or beat off only in cold storage. Wally told Homer that only Mr. Rose knew how to write, that the pranks and insults and shopping lists were all composed by Mr. Rose, but Homer could never be sure. Every summer, Mr. Rose would write to Wally, and Wally would tell Mr. Rose how many pickers he needed, and Mr. Rose would say how many he was bringing, and the day they would arrive, give or take. No contract ever existed, just the short, reliable assurances from Mr. Rose. Some summers he came with a woman, large and soft and quiet, with a baby girl riding her hip. By the time the little girl could run around and get into trouble, she was about the age of Angel Wells, Mr. Rose stopped bringing her or the woman. For 15 years, the only migrant who was as constant as Mr. Rose was Black Pan, the cook. "How's your little girl?" Homer Wells would ask Mr. Rose, every year that the woman and the daughter didn't show up again. "She growin' like your boy," Mr. Rose would say. "And how's your lady?" Homer would ask. "She lookin' after the little girl," Mr. Rose would say. Only once in 15 years did Homer Wells approach Mr. Rose on the subject of the cider house rules. "I hope they don't offend anyone," Homer began. "I'm responsible. I write them every year. And if anyone takes offense, I hope you'll tell me." "No offense," said Mr. Rose, smiling. "They're just little rules," Homer said. "Yes," said Mr. Rose, "they are. But it does concern me that no one seems to pay attention to them," Homer finally said. Mr. Rose, whose bland face was unchanged by the years, and whose body had remained thin and lithe, looked at Homer mildly. "We got our own rules, too, Homer," he said. "Your own rules," said Homer Wells. "About lots of things," said Mr. Rose. "About how much we can have to do with you, for one thing."
"With me?" Homer said.
"With white people," said Mr. Rose. "We got our rules about that."
"I see," Homer said,
but he didn't really see.
"And about fighting?" said Mr. Rose.
"Fighting," said Homer Wells.
"With each other," said Mr. Rose. "One rule is we can't cut each other bad. Not bad enough for no hospital, not bad enough for no police. We can cut each other, but not bad."
"I see," Homer said.
"No, you don't," said Mr. Rose. "You don't see. That's the point. We can cut each other only so bad that you never see. You never know we was cut, you see?"
"Right," said Homer Wells.
"When you gonna say something else?" Mr. Rose asked, smiling.
"Just be careful on the roof," Homer advised him.
"Nothing too bad can happen up there," Mr. Rose told him. "Worse things can happen on the ground." Homer Wells was on the verge of saying right again when he discovered that he couldn't talk. Mr. Rose had seized his tongue between his blunt, square-ended index finger and his thumb. A vague taste like dust was in Homer's mouth. Mr. Rose's hand had been so fast, Homer had never seen it. He never knew before that someone could actually catch hold of someone's tongue.
"Got ya," said Mr. Rose, smiling. He let Homer's tongue go.
Homer managed to say, "You're very fast."
"Right," said Mr. Rose alertly. "Ain't no one faster."
Wally complained to Homer about the yearly wear and tear on the cider house roof. Every 2 or 3 years they had to re-tin the roof or fix the flashing or put up new gutters. "What's having his own rules got to do with not paying attention to ours?" Wally asked Homer.
"I don't know," Homer said.
"Write a letter and ask him." But no one wanted to offend Mr. Rose. He was a reliable crew boss. He made the picking and the pressing go smoothly every harvest. Candy, who managed the money at Ocean View, claimed that whatever costs they absorbed in repairs to the cider house roof were more than compensated for by Mr. Rose's reliability.
"There's something a little gangland style about the guy," Wally said, not exactly complaining.
"I mean, I don't really want to know how he gets all those pickers to behave themselves." But they do behave themselves, Homer said.
He does a good job, Candy said. Let him have his own rules.
Homer Wells looked away. He knew that rules for Candy were all private contracts. 15 years ago, they had made their own rules. Or really, Candy had made them, before Wally came home. They stood in the cider house, after Angel was born, on a night when Olive was looking after Angel. They had just made love, but not happily. Something was wrong. It would be wrong for 15 years, but that night Candy had said, "Let's agree to something."
"Okay," Homer said. "Whatever happens, we share Angel."
"Of course," Homer said.
"I mean, you get to be his father, you get all the father time you want to have, and I get to have all the mother time I need," Candy said.
"Always," said Homer Wells. But something was wrong.
"I mean, regardless of what happens, whether I'm with you or with Wally," Candy said.
Homer was quiet for a while. "So you're leaning toward Wally?" he asked.
"I'm not leaning anywhere," Candy said. "I'm standing right here, and we're agreeing to certain rules."
"I didn't know they were rules," said Homer Wells.
"We share Angel," Candy said. "We both get to live with him. We get to be his family. Nobody ever moves out."
"Even if you're with Wally?" Homer said after a while.
"Remember what you told me when you wanted me to have Angel?" Candy asked him.
Homer Wells was cautious now.
"Remind me," he said.
"You said that he was your baby, too, that he was ours, that I couldn't decide all by myself not to have him. That was the point," Candy said.
"Yes," Homer said, "I remember."
"Well, if he was ours then, he's ours now, whatever happens," Candy repeated.
"In the same house?" asked Homer Wells. "Even if you go with Wally?"
"Like a family," Candy said.
"Like a family," said Homer Wells.
It was a word that took a strong grip of him. "An orphan is a child forever. An orphan detests change. An orphan hates to move. An orphan loves routine." For 15 years, Homer Wells knew that there were possibly as many cider house rules as there were people who had passed through the cider house. Even so, every year, he posted a fresh list.
For 15 years, the Board of Trustees had tried and failed to replace Dr. Larch. They couldn't find anyone who wanted the job. There were people dying to throw themselves into unrewarded service of their fellow man, but there were more exotic places than St. Cloud's where their services were needed, and where they could also suffer. The Board of Trustees couldn't manage to entice a new nurse into service there either. They couldn't hire even an administrative assistant. When Dr. Gingrich retired, not from the board, he would never retire from the board, he mused about accepting the position in St. Cloud's, but Mrs. Goodhall pointed out to him that he wasn't an obstetrician. His psychiatric practice had never flourished in Maine, yet Dr. Gingrich was surprised and a little hurt to learn that Mrs. Goodhall enjoyed pointing this out to him. Mrs. Goodhall had reached retirement age herself, but nothing could have been farther from that woman's zealous mind. Wilbur Larch was 90-something, and Mrs. Goodhall was obsessed with retiring him before he died. She realized that to have Larch die while still in service would register as a kind of defeat for her. Not long ago, perhaps in an effort to invigorate the board, Dr. Gingrich had proposed they hold a meeting in an off-season hotel in Agunquit, simply to break the routine of meeting in their usual offices in Portland. "Make it a kind of outing," he proposed, "the ocean air and all." But it rained. In the colder weather, the wood shrank, the sand got in the windows and doors and crunched underfoot, the drapes and the towels and the bedsheets were gritty. The wind was off the ocean. No one could sit on the veranda because the wind blew the rain under the roof. The hotel provided them with a long, dark, empty dining room. They held their meeting under a chandelier that no one could turn on. No one could find the right switch. It was appropriate to their discussion of St. Cloud's that they attempted to conduct their business in a former ballroom that had seen better days. in a hotel so deeply in the off-season that anyone seeing them there would have suspected they'd been quarantined. In fact, when he got a glimpse of them, that is what Homer Wells thought. He and Candy were the hotel's only other off-season guests. They had taken a room for half the day. They were a long way from Ocean View, but they'd come this far to be sure that no one would recognize them. It was time for them to leave. They stood outside on the veranda, Candy with her back against Homer's chest, his arms wrapped around her. They both faced out to sea. He appeared to like the way the wind whipped her hair back in his face, and neither of them seemed to mind the rain. Inside the hotel, Mrs. Goodhall looked through the streaked window, frowning at the weather and at the young couple braving the elements. In her opinion, nothing could ever be normal enough. That was what was wrong with Larch. Not everyone who is 90-something is senile, she would grant you, but Larch wasn't normal. And even if they were a young married couple, public displays of affection were not acceptable to Mrs. Goodhall, and they were calling all the more attention to themselves by their defiance of the rain. "What's more," she remarked to Dr. Gingrich, who was given no warning and had no map with which he could have followed her thoughts, "I'll bet they're not married." The young couple, he thought, looked a little sad. Perhaps they needed a psychiatrist. Perhaps it was the weather. They'd been planning to sail. "I figured out what he is," Mrs. Goodhall told Dr. Gingrich, who thought she was referring to the young man, Homer Wells. "He's a non-practicing homosexual," Mrs. Goodhall announced. She meant Dr. Larch, who was on her mind night and day. Dr. Gingrich was rather amazed at what struck him as Mrs. Goodhall's wild guess, but he looked at the young man with renewed interest. True, he was not actually fondling the young woman. He seemed a trifle distant. "If we could catch him at it, we'd have him out in a minute," Mrs. Goodhall observed. "Of course, we'd still have to find someone willing to replace him." Dr. Gingrich was lost. He realized that Mrs. Goodhall couldn't be interested in replacing the young man on the veranda, and that therefore she was still thinking about Dr. Larch. But if Dr. Larch were a non-practicing homosexual, what could they ever catch him at? "We would catch him at being a homosexual, not just practicing as such?" Dr. Gingrich asked cautiously. It was not hard to rile Mrs. Goodhall. "He's obviously queer," she snapped. Dr. Gingrich, in all his years of psychiatric service to Maine, had never been moved to apply the label of non-practicing homosexual to anyone, although he had often heard of such a thing. Usually, someone was complaining about someone else's peculiarity. In Mrs. Goodhall's case, she despised men who lived alone. It wasn't normal. And she despised young couples who displayed their affection, or weren't married, or both. Too much of what was normal also enraged her. Although he shared with Mrs. Goodhall the desire to replace Dr. Larch and his staff at St. Cloud's, it occurred to Dr. Gingrich that he should have had Mrs. Goodhall as a patient. She might have kept him out of retirement for a few more years. When the young couple came inside the hotel, Mrs. Goodhall gave them such a look that the young woman turned away. "Did you see her turn away in shame?" Mrs. Goodhall would ask Dr. Gingrich later. But the young man stared her down. He looked right through her. Dr. Gingrich marveled. It was one of the best looks, in the tradition of withering, that Dr. Gingrich had ever seen, and he found himself smiling at the young couple. "Did you see that couple?" Candy asked him later, in the long drive back to Ocean View. "I don't think they were married," said Homer Wells. "Or if they're married, they hate each other." "Maybe that's why I thought they were married," Candy said. "He looked a little stupid, and she looked completely crazy," Homer said. "I know they were married," Candy said. In the sad, dingy dining room in Agunquit, while the rain pelted down, Mrs. Goodhall said, "It's just not normal. Dr. Larch, those old nurses, the whole bit. If someone new in some capacity isn't hired soon, I say we send a janitor up there, just anyone who can look the place over and tell us how bad it is." "Maybe it's not as bad as we think," Dr. Gingrich said tiredly. He had seen the young couple leave the hotel, and they had filled him with melancholy.
Let somebody go there and see, Mrs. Goodhall said, the dark chandelier above her small gray head.
Then, in the nick of time, in everyone's opinion, a new nurse came to St. Cloud's. Remarkably, she appeared to have found out about the place all by herself. Nurse Caroline, they called her. She was constantly of use, and a great help when Melanie's present for Mrs. Grogan arrived.
"What is it?" Mrs. Grogan asked.
The carton was almost too heavy for her to lift. Nurse Edna and Nurse Angela had brought it over to the girls' division together. It was a sweltering summer afternoon. Still, because it had been a perfectly windless day, Nurse Edna had sprayed the apple trees. Dr. Larch came to the girls' division to see what was in the package.
"Well, go on, open it," he said to Mrs. Grogan. "I haven't got all day."
Mrs. Grogan was not sure how to attack the carton, which was sealed with wire and twine and tape, as if a savage had attempted to contain a wild animal. Nurse Caroline was called for her help.
What would they do without Nurse Caroline? Larch wondered.
Before the package for Mrs. Grogan, Nurse Caroline had been the only large gift that anyone sent to St. Cloud's. Homer Wells had sent her from the hospital in Cape Kenneth. Homer Wells knew that Nurse Caroline believed in the Lord's work, and he had persuaded her to go where her devotion would be welcome. But Nurse Caroline had trouble opening Melanie's present.
"Who left it?" Mrs. Grogan asked.
"Someone named Lorna," Nurse Angela said. "I never saw her before."
"I never saw her before either," said Wilbur Larch.
When the package was opened, there was still a mystery. Inside was a huge coat, much too large for Mrs. Grogan. An army surplus coat, made for the Alaskan service, it had a hood and a fur collar, and it was so heavy that when Mrs. Grogan tried it on, it almost dragged her to the floor. She lost her balance a little and wobbled around like a top, losing its spin. The coat had all sorts of secret pockets, which were probably for weapons or mess kits.
"Or the severed arms and legs of enemies," said Dr. Larch.
Mrs. Grogan, lost in the coat and perspiring, said, "I don't get it." Then she felt the money in one of the pockets. She took out several loose bills and counted them, which was when she remembered that it was the exact amount of money that Melanie had stolen from her when Melanie had left St. Cloud's and taken Mrs. Grogan's coat with her more than 15 years ago.
"Oh, my God!" Mrs. Grogan cried, fainting.
Nurse Caroline ran to the train station, but Lorna's train had already left. When Mrs. Grogan was revived, she cried and cried.
"Oh, that dear girl!" she cried,
while everyone soothed her and no one spoke. Larch and Nurse Angela and Nurse Edna remembered Melanie as anything but dear. Larch tried on the coat, which was also too big and heavy for him. He staggered around in it for a while, frightening one of the smaller girls in the girls' division who'd come into the lobby to investigate Mrs. Grogan's cries. Larch found something in another pocket, the snipped, twisted ends of some copper wire and a pair of rubber-handled, insulated wire cutters. On his way back to the boys' division, Larch whispered to Nurse Angela,
"I'll bet she robbed some electrician."
"A big electrician," Nurse Angela said.
"You too," Nurse Edna scolded them. "It's a warm coat, anyway. At least it'll keep her warm."
"It'll give her a heart attack, lugging it around," Dr. Larch said.
"I can wear it," Nurse Caroline commented.
It was the first time that Larch and his old nurses realized that Nurse Caroline was not only young and energetic, she was also big and strong, and, in a much less crude and vulgar way, a little reminiscent of Melanie. If Melanie had been a Marxist, thought Wilbur Larch, and an angel. Larch had trouble with the word angel since Homer Wells and Candy had taken their son away from St. Cloud's. Larch had trouble with the whole idea of how Homer was living. For 15 years, Wilbur Larch had been amazed that the three of them, Homer and Candy and Wally, had managed it. He wasn't at all sure what they had managed or at what cost. He knew, of course, that Angel was a wanted child and well-loved and well-looked after, or else Larch couldn't have remained silent. It was difficult for him to remain silent about the rest of it. How had they arranged it?
But who am I to advocate honesty in all relationships, he wondered. Me with my fictional histories, me with my fictional heart defects, me with my fuzzy stone. And who was he to ask exactly what the sexual relationship was? Did he need to remind himself that he had slept with someone else's mother and dressed himself in the light of her daughter's cigar? That he had allowed to die a woman who had put a pony's penis in her mouth for money? Larch looked out the window at the apple orchard on the hill. That summer of 1950-something, the trees were thriving. The apples were mostly pale green and pink. The leaves were a vibrant dark green. The trees were almost too tall for Nurse Edna to spray with the Indian pump. I should ask Nurse Caroline to take over the tending of them, Dr. Larch thought. He wrote a note to himself and left it in the typewriter. The heat made him drowsy. He went to the dispensary and stretched himself out on the bed. In the summer, with the windows open, he could risk a slightly heavier dose, he thought. The last summer that Mr. Rose was in charge of the picking crew at Ocean View was the summer of 1950-something, when Angel Wells was 15. All that summer, Angel had been looking forward to the next summer, when he would be 16, old enough to have his driver's license. By that time, he imagined, he would have saved enough money from his summer jobs in the orchards and from his contribution to the harvests to buy his first car. His father, Homer Wells, didn't own a car. When Homer went shopping in town, or when he volunteered at the hospital in Cape Kenneth, he used one of the farm vehicles. The old Cadillac, which had been equipped with a hand-operated brake and accelerator so Wally could drive it, was often available, and Candy had her own car, a lemon-yellow Jeep in which she had taught Angel to drive, and which was as reliable in the orchards as it was sturdy on the public roads. "I taught your father how to swim," Candy always told Angel. "I guess I can teach you how to drive." Of course, Angel knew how to drive all the farm vehicles, too. He knew how to mow and how to spray and how to operate the forklift. The driver's license was simply necessary, official approval of something Angel already did very well on the farm. And for a 15-year-old, he looked much older. He could have driven all over Maine, and no one would have questioned him. He would be taller than his boyish, round-faced father. They were dead even as the summer began. And there was a defined angularity in the bones of his face that made him seem already grown up. Even the trace of a beard was there. The shadows under his eyes were not unhealthy-looking. They served only to accent the vivid darkness of his eyes. It was a joke between father and son, that the shadows under Angel's eyes were inherited. "You get your insomnia from me," Homer Wells would tell his son, who still thought he was adopted. "You've got no reason to feel adopted," his father had told him. "You've got three parents, really. The best that most people get is two." Candy had been like a mother to him, and Wally was a second father, or the favorite, eccentric uncle. The only life Angel had known was a life with all of them. At 15, he'd never suffered so much as a change of rooms. Everything had been the same since he could remember it. He had what had been Wally's room, the one Wally had shared with Homer. Angel had been born into a real boy's room. He'd grown up surrounded by Wally's tennis and swimming trophies, and the pictures of Candy with Wally, when Wally's legs worked, and even the picture of Candy teaching Homer how to swim. Wally's purple heart, which Wally had given to Angel, was hung on the wall over the boy's bed. It concealed an oddly smeared fingerprint. Olive's fingerprint, from the night when she'd crushed a mosquito against that wall, which was the same night Angel Wells had been conceived in the cider house. After 15 years, the wall needed a fresh coat of paint. Homer's room down the hall had been the master bedroom. It had been Olive's room and the room where Senior had died. Olive herself had died in Cape Kenneth Hospital before the war was over, even before they'd sent Wally home. It was an inoperable cancer which spread very quickly after they'd done the exploratory. Homer and Candy and Ray had taken turns visiting her. One of them was always with Angel, but Olive was never alone. Homer and Candy had said, privately, only to each other,
that things might have worked out differently if Wally had made it back to the States before Olive died. Because of Wally's precariousness and the added difficulty of moving him in wartime, it was thought best not to tell Wally of Olive's cancer. That was how Olive had wanted it, too. In the end, Olive thought Wally had come home. She was pumped so full of painkillers that she mistook Homer for Wally in their last few meetings. Homer had been in the habit of reading to her, from Jane Eyre, from David Copperfield, and from Great Expectations. But he gave that up when Olive's attention began to wander. The first few times Olive confused Homer with Wally, Homer couldn't be sure whom she thought she was addressing.
"You must forgive him," Olive said.
Her speech was slurred. She took Homer's hand, which she did not really hold so much as contain in her lap.
"Forgive him?" said Homer Wells.
"Yes," Olive said. "He can't help how much he loves her, or how much he needs her."
To Candy, Olive was clearer.
"He's going to be crippled, and he's going to lose me. If he loses you, too, who's going to look after him?"
"I'll always look after him," Candy said. "Homer and I will look after him." But Olive was not so drugged that she failed to detect and dislike the ambiguity of Candy's answer.
"It's not right to hurt or deceive someone who's already been hurt and deceived, Candy," she said.
With the drugs she was taking, Olive felt a perfect freedom. It was not for her to tell them that she knew what she knew. It was for them to tell her what they were keeping from her. Until they told her, she could keep them guessing about what she knew. To Homer, Olive said,
"He's an orphan."
"Who is?" Homer asked.
"He is," she said. "Don't you forget how needy an orphan is. He'll take everything. He's come from having nothing. When he sees what he can have, he'll take everything he sees."
"My son," Olive said, "don't blame anyone. Blame will kill you."
"Yes," said Homer Wells, who held Olive's hand. When he bent over her to hear how she was breathing, she kissed him as if he were Wally. "Blame will kill you," he repeated to Candy, after Olive had died. "Dread remorse," said Homer Wells, forever recalling Mr. Rochester's advice. "Don't quote to me," Candy told him. "The thing is, he's coming home, and he doesn't even know his mother's dead. Not to mention," Candy said. Then she stopped talking. "Not to mention," said Homer Wells. Candy and Wally were married less than a month after Wally returned to Ocean View. Wally weighed 147 pounds, and Homer Wells pushed the wheelchair down the church aisle. Candy and Wally occupied the converted bedroom on the ground floor of the big house. Homer Wells had written to Wilbur Larch shortly after Wally had come home. Olive's death, Homer wrote to Larch, had fixed things for Candy and Wally more securely than Wally's paralysis, or than whatever sense of betrayal and guilt might have plagued Candy. "Candy's right. Don't worry about Angel," Wilbur Larch had written to Homer Wells. "Angel will get enough love. Why would he feel like an orphan if he never is one? If you're a good father to him, and Candy's a good mother to him, and if he's got Wally loving him too, do you think he's going to start missing some idea of who his so-called real father is? The problem is not going to be Angel's problem. It's going to be yours. You're going to want him to know you're his real father because of you, not because he's going to need to know. The problem is you're going to need to tell, you and Candy. You're going to be proud. It will be for you, and not for Angel, that you're going to want to tell him he's no orphan." And to himself, or as an entry in a brief history of St. Cloud's, Wilbur Larch wrote, "Here in St. Cloud's we have just one problem. His name is Homer Wells. He's a problem wherever he goes." Aside from the darkness in his eyes and an ability to sustain a pensive, faraway look that was both alert and dreaming, Angel Wells resembled his father very little. He never thought of himself as an orphan. He knew he had been adopted, and he knew he came from where his father came from, and he knew he was loved. He had always felt it.
What did it matter that he called Candy, Candy, and Homer, Dad, and Wally, Wally? This was the second summer that Angel Wells had been strong enough to carry Wally, up some steps, or into the surf, or out of the shallow end of the pool, and back into the wheelchair. Homer had taught Angel how to carry Wally into the surf when they went to the beach. Wally was a better swimmer than any of them, but he needed to get into deep enough water so that he could either float over a wave or duck under one. "You just can't let him get dragged around in the shallow water," Homer had explained to his son. There were some rules regarding Wally. There were always rules, Angel had observed. As good a swimmer as he was, Wally was never allowed to swim alone, and for many summers now Angel Wells had been Wally's lifeguard whenever Wally swam his laps or just floated in the pool. Almost half the physical contact between Wally and Angel occurred in the water, where they resembled otters or seals. They wrestled and dunked each other so ferociously that Candy couldn't help being anxious at times for both of them. And Wally was not allowed to drive alone. Even though the Cadillac had hand-operated controls, someone else had to collapse the wheelchair and put it in or take it out of the back of the car. The first collapsible wheelchairs were quite heavy. Although Wally would occasionally drag himself through the ground floor of the house using one of those metal walkers, his legs were mere props. In unfamiliar terrain, he needed his wheelchair, and in rough terrain, he needed a pusher. So many times the pusher had been Angel, and so many times Angel had been the passenger in the Cadillac. Although Homer and Candy might have complained if they had known, Wally had long ago taught Angel to drive the Cadillac. "The hand controls make it easy, kiddo," Wally would say. "Your legs don't have to be long enough to reach the pedals." And that was not what Candy had told Angel about teaching him to drive in the Jeep. "Just as soon as your legs are long enough to reach the pedals," she had told him, kissing him, which she did whenever she had the excuse, "I'll teach you how to drive." When the time came, it never occurred to Candy that Angel had been so easy to teach because he'd been driving the Cadillac for years. "Some rules are good rules, kiddo," Wally would tell the boy, kissing him, which Wally did a lot, especially in the water. "But some rules are just rules. You just gotta break them carefully." "It's dumb that I have to be 16 before I get a driver's license," Angel told his father. "Right," said Homer Wells. "They should make an exception for kids who grow up on farms." Sometimes Angel played tennis with Candy, but more often he hit balls back to Wally, who maintained his good strokes even sitting down. The club members had complained a little about the wheelchair tracks on the clay, but what would the Haven Club have been without tolerating one or another Worthington eccentricity? Wally would set the wheelchair in a fixed position and hit only forehands for 15 or 20 minutes. Angel's responsibility was to get the ball exactly to him. Then Wally would move the chair and hit only backhands. "It's actually better practice for you than for me, kiddo," Wally would tell Angel. "At least, I'm not getting any better." Angel got a lot better. He was so much better than Candy that it sometimes hurt his mother's feelings when she detected how boring it was for Angel to play with her. Homer Wells didn't play tennis. He had never been a games man. He had resisted even the indoor football at St. Cloud's, although he occasionally dreamed of stickball, usually with Nurse Angela pitching. She was always the hardest to hit. And Homer Wells had no hobbies, nothing beyond following Angel around, as if Homer were his son's pet, a dog waiting to be played with. Pillow fights in the dark, they'd been popular for a few years. Kissing each other good night, and then finding excuses to repeat the ritual, and finding novel ways to wake each other in the mornings. If Homer was bored, he was also busy. He had continued his volunteer work for Cape Kenneth Hospital. In a sense, he had never stopped his war effort, his service as a nurse's aide. And he was a veteran reader of medical literature. The Journal of the American Medical Association and the New England Journal of Medicine were very acceptably piled up on the tables and in the bookcases of the Ocean View House. Candy objected to the illustrations in the American Journal of Obstetrics and Gynecology. "I need a little intellectual stimulation around here," Homer Wells would say whenever Candy complained about the graphic nature of his material.
I just don't think that Angel has to see it, Candy said. He knows I have a little background in the subject, Homer said. I don't object to what he knows, I object to the pictures, Candy said.
There's no reason to mystify the subject for the child, Wally said, taking Homer aside.
There's no need to make the subject grotesque, either, Candy argued.
I don't think it's either a mystery or grotesque, Angel said that summer he was 15.
It's just interesting.
You're not even going out with girls yet, Candy said, laughing, and taking the opportunity to kiss him. But when she bent over him to kiss him, she saw in her son's lap the illustration that was featured in an article on vaginal operations. The illustration indicated the lines of incision for the removal of the vulva and a primary tumor in an extended radical vulvectomy.
Homer! Candy shouted.
Homer was upstairs in his very spare bedroom.
His life was so spare he'd tacked only two things on his walls, and one of those was in his bathroom. By his bed he had a picture of Wally in his flyer's scarf and sheepskin. Wally was posing with the crew of Opportunity Knox. The shadow from the wing of the dark plane completely obscured the face of the radio man, and the glare of the Indian sun completely whited out the face of the crew chief, who had eventually died of his colon complication. Only Wally and the co-pilot were correctly illuminated, although Homer had seen better pictures of them both. The co-pilot sent Wally a picture of himself and his growing family every Christmas. He had five or six children and a plump wife. But every year the co-pilot looked thinner. The amoeba he'd contracted in Burma had never entirely left him. And in the bathroom, Homer had tacked up the blank questionnaire, the extra copy, the one he'd never sent to the Board of Trustees of St. Cloud's. The exposure to the steam from the shower had given to the paper of the questionnaire the texture of a parchment lampshade, but each question had remained readable and idiotic. The master bed was higher than most, because in his day Senior Worthington had enjoyed looking out the window while lying down. It was a feature Homer also appreciated about the bed. He could oversee the pool from up there, and he could see the cider house roof. He liked to lie on that bed for hours, just looking out the window. Homer, Candy called to him, please come see what your son is reading.
That was the way they all talked. Candy said, your son, to Homer, and that's how Wally spoke, too, and Angel always said Dad or Pop when he addressed his father. It had been an uninterrupted 15-year relationship. Homer and Angel upstairs, Wally and Candy in the former dining room downstairs. The four of them ate their meals together. Some nights, especially in winter, when the bare trees permitted more of a view of the lit dining room and kitchen windows of strangers' houses, Homer Wells liked to take a short car ride before dinner. He wondered about the families who were eating dinner together. What were their real lives like? St. Cloud's had been more predictable. What did anyone really know about all those families sitting down to have a meal?
We are a family. Isn't that the main thing? Candy asked Homer Wells, whenever Homer appeared to her to be taking longer and longer drives before dinner.
Angel has a family, a really wonderful family. Yes, that's the main thing, Homer agreed.
And when Wally would tell her how happy he was, how he felt he was the luckiest man alive, how anyone would give up his legs to be as happy as Wally was, those were the nights that Candy couldn't sleep. Those were the nights when she'd be aware of Homer Wells, who was wide awake, too. Some nights they would meet in the kitchen. They'd have some milk and apple pie. Some nights, when it was warm, they'd sit by the swimming pool, not touching each other. To any observer, the space between them would have indicated a quarrel, although they rarely quarreled, or else indifference, but they were never indifferent to each other. The way they sat by the pool reminded them both of how they used to sit on Ray Kendall's dock before they'd sat closer together. If ever they were too conscious of this memory, and of missing that dock, or of missing Ray, who died before Angel was old enough to have any memory of him, this would spoil their evening by the swimming pool, and they would be forced back to their separate bedrooms, where they would lie awake a little longer. As he grew older, and almost as insomniac as his father, Angel Wells would often watch Homer and Candy sitting by the pool, which he could also see out the window of his room.
If Angel ever thought anything about the two of them sitting out there, it was why such old friends sat so far apart. Raymond Kendall had died shortly after Wally and Candy were married. He was killed when the lobster pound blew up. His whole dock was blown apart, and his lobster boat sank, and two old heaps of automobiles he was working on were jolted across his parking lot a good 25 yards down the coastal highway by the explosion, as if they'd been driven under their own power. Even the picture window at the Haven Club was collapsed by the blast. But it happened so late at night that the bar was closed, and none of the Haven Club's regular drinkers was on hand to see their favorite eyesore obliterated from their view of Hartshaven Harbor. Ray had been tinkering with his homemade torpedo. For all of his legendary mechanical genius, he must have found out something about a torpedo that he didn't know. The misfortune of someone you love can bring out the guilt in you. Candy regretted that she'd not told her father about Homer and Angel Wells. It was no consolation to her that she imagined Ray already knew everything. She had been able to understand, by his silences, that he wanted to hear it from her. Yet not even the death of her father could prompt Candy Kendall to tell her story to anyone. As far south along the coastal highway as Powell's Ice Cream Palace, there had been dead lobsters and lobster parts in the parking lot and in the road. This had prompted Herb Fowler, who was never caught without something funny to say, to ask old Mr. Powell if he was inventing a new flavor of ice cream. Herb had waited for the summer that Angel Wells was 15 before he flicked Angel his first rubber. Angel's feelings were slightly hurt that Herb had not initiated him sooner. Angel's pal and co-worker, Pudgy Pete Hyde, was only a few months older than Angel, and not nearly so grown up in countless ways, and Angel knew that Herb Fowler had bounced a rubber off Pete Hyde's head when Pete was only 13. What Angel hadn't yet fathomed was that Pete Hyde was a part of Ocean View's working-class family, and Angel, although he worked with the workers, was from the boss's family. The workers knew that Homer Wells ran Ocean View. He was the one most in charge. This would not have surprised Olive, and it was clear that Candy and Wally were grateful for Homer's authority. Perhaps because the workers knew that Homer had come from St. Cloud's, they felt that he was closer to them. He lived in what Big Dot Taft called the Fancy House, but he was like one of them. None of the workers resented that Homer was the boss, with the possible exception of Vernon Lynch, who resented any and every authority, all the more so since Grace Lynch had died. Candy, who looked into the matters concerning the workers' wives, discovered that Grace had been pregnant. She died of acute peritonitis, following a misguided attempt to abort herself. Homer, who would often wonder why she had not chosen to make a second trip to St. Cloud's, liked to think that she had not died in vain. It had been her death, and Dr. Harlow's particularly unsympathetic response to it, that had prompted Nurse Caroline to resign from the Cape Kenneth Hospital staff, as Homer Wells had been encouraging her to do. Nurse Caroline finally took Homer's suggestion and offered her services to St. Cloud's. "Homer Wells sent me," Nurse Caroline said when she introduced herself to Wilbur Larch. The old man had not grown too careless. "Sent you for what?" Larch asked. "I'm a trained nurse," she said. "I'm here to help you." "Help me do what?" asked Larch, who was not very convincing at portraying innocence. "I believe in the Lord's work," Nurse Caroline said, exasperated. "Well, why didn't you say so?" Wilbur Larch asked. "So he's given me something besides apple trees," the old man mused. "So there's still hope for him." Nurse Angela and Nurse Edna were so relieved to get Nurse Caroline that they weren't even jealous. Here was the new blood that might hold the Board of Trustees at bay a while longer. "The new nurse is a definite improvement to the situation," Dr. Gingrich confided to the board. "I would say that she takes a lot of pressure off making any immediate decision." As if they weren't trying to replace the old man every minute. "I'd prefer a young doctor to a young nurse," Mrs. Goodhall declared. "A young doctor and a young administrator. You know how I feel about the records. The records of that place are pure whimsy. But it's at least a temporary improvement, I'll buy that," she said.
If Wilbur Larch could have heard her, he would have said, "Just give me the time, lady, and you'll buy more than that." But in 1950-something, Wilbur Larch was 90-something. Sometimes his face would hold so still under the ether cone that the mask would stay in place after his hand had dropped to his side. Only the force of his exhalations would make the cone fall. He had lost a lot of weight. In a mirror, or traveling with his beloved ether, he had the impression that he was becoming a bird. Only Nurse Caroline had the courage to criticize his drug habit. "You should know, of all people," Nurse Caroline told him roughly.
"Me, of all people?" Larch asked innocently.
Sometimes he found it was fun to provoke her.
"You have a low opinion of religion," Nurse Caroline remarked to him.
"I suppose so," he said cautiously. She was a little too young and quick for him, he knew.
"Well, what do you suppose a drug dependency is, if not a kind of religion?" Nurse Caroline asked.
"I have no quarrel with anyone at prayer," Wilbur Larch said. "Prayer is personal. Prayer is anyone's choice. Pray to whom or what you want. It's when you start making rules," said Wilbur Larch, but he felt lost. He knew she could talk circles around him. He admired socialism, but talking to a damn socialist was like talking to any true believer. He had heard her say so many times that a society that approved of making abortion illegal was a society that approved of violence against women, that making abortion illegal was simply a sanctimonious, self-righteous form of violence against women. It was just a way of legalizing violence against women, Nurse Caroline would say. He had heard her say so many times that abortions were not only a personal freedom of choice, but also a responsibility of the state, to provide them.
"Once the state starts providing, it feels free to hand out the rules, too," Larch blurted hastily.
It was a Yankee thing to say, very Maine. But Nurse Caroline smiled. That led him into another of her arguments. She could always trap him. He was not a systems man, he was just a good one.
"In a better world," she began patiently.
Her patience with him could make Larch furious.
"No, not in a better world," he cried. "In this one. In this world. I take this world as a given. Talk to me about this world."
But it all made him so tired. It made him want a little ether. The more he tried to keep up with Nurse Caroline, the more he needed ether. And the stronger he felt his need for it, the more that made her right.
"Oh, I can't always be right," Larch said tiredly.
"Yes, I know," Nurse Caroline said sympathetically.
"It's because even a good man can't always be right that we need a society, that we need certain rules. Call them priorities, if you prefer," she said.
"You can call them whatever you want," said Wilbur Larch testily. "I don't have time for philosophy, or for government, or for religion. I don't have enough time," said Wilbur Larch. Always in the background of his mind, there was a newborn baby crying. Even when the orphanage was as silent as the few remaining abandoned buildings of St. Cloud's, even when it was ghostly quiet, Wilbur Larch heard babies crying. And they were not crying to be born, he knew. They were crying because they were born. That summer, Mr. Rose wrote that he and the daughter might be arriving a day or so ahead of the picking crew. He hoped the cider house would be ready.
"It's been a while since we've seen the daughter," Wally remarked, in the Applemart office.
Everett Taft was outside oiling Wally's wheelchair for him, so Wally sat on the desk, his withered legs swinging limply, his unused feet in a perfectly polished pair of loafers. The loafers were more than 15 years old. Candy was playing with the adding machine.
"I think the daughter is about Angel's age," she said.
"Right," said Homer Wells. And Wally hit Homer with a very well-thrown jab, the only sort of punch he could really throw sitting down. Because Homer had been leaning on the desk and Wally had been sitting up straight, the punch caught Homer completely by surprise, and very solidly, in the cheek. The punch surprised Candy so much that she pushed the adding machine off the far corner of the desk. The machine crashed to the office floor. When Homer hit the floor, he did not land quite as loudly or as dead weight as the adding machine, but he landed hard.